Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. We have Danae Logan on, and she is a marriage and family therapist, a group facilitator, and author based in Los Angeles. In addition to her work with clients in private practice, she is a mindfulness coach, a yoga teacher, and specializes in supporting couples in finding more fulfillment in their relationships. Danae utilizes her background in depth psychology to explore how each of us can reclaim the aspects of our authentic selves we've been conditioned to turn away from in order to maintain attachments. Danae is also the co-host of the podcast Cheaper Than Therapy, which I was on. What an amazing show. You have to check it out, please. It is so powerful and unbelievable in all aspects of a podcast. And her first book, Sovereign Love, A Guide to Healing Relationships by Reclaiming the Masculine and Feminine Within, is being released by Sounds True in May of 2024. Keep your eyes peeled for that. In this episode, we dive into the spirituality and the soul of a couple, tapping into Carl Jung and depth psychology and the archetypes and the things that we have fit into or maybe have been pushed into. Who knows? But that's what we talk about in this week's episode. So honored to have her on. Let's hear a word from our sponsors and get right into it. Hey, I want to thank Alma for sponsoring this week's episode. You know, building a private practice can be really challenging. I know for me, I was so scared of how I was going to get the right clients, the right fit, and them being able to pay. And taking insurance is really scary. Growing your caseload, navigating insurance, and managing billing and paperwork all take so much time. And that's all in addition to doing your best and delivering amazing care to your clients. That's why Alma gives clinicians the tools they need to build thriving private practices. When you join their insurance program, you can get credentialed within 45 days and access enhanced reimbursement rates with major payers. They also handle all the paperwork from eligibility checks to claim submissions and guarantee payment within 2 weeks of each appointment. In addition to their insurance program, Alma offers time-saving tools and administrative support so you can spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering great care to your clients. Learn more about building a thriving private practice with Alma at helloalma.com. That's helloalma.com to get started. Welcome to this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. We have Danae Logan on. And, you know, I got to tell you, there are a lot of people who have like their spirit and heart on their sleeves. And there's something about you that is just so present with those two things. So you didn't think you were coming on to be like hype, you know? Welcome.
Thanks,
welcome to The Dude Therapist, where I hype my guests up. And because I really admire the people that I have on my show. And you just have this air about you that is so real. And so I'm so excited to have you on. And before I continue making you feel amazing about yourself, if you'd like, I'm for hire if you want. Can you introduce yourself to the listener so they get a little taste of who you are before we dive into the conversation?
Well, sure. Thanks for that, Eli. My heart's exploding already. I'm so grateful to be here and get to hang out with you for a bit. And yeah, it's so nice to meet you face to face. I feel like we've been conversing in the social media spheres for a while now. I'm Danae Logan, as you mentioned. I'm a marriage and family therapist located in Los Angeles. I'm also a mindfulness coach and a group facilitator. I facilitate a lot of retreats throughout the year for, you know, people just really having a look at some of their codependent tendencies and the ways that we're conditioned to self-abandon and all of the things that we talk about in the therapy room that I know you're very familiar with. And let's see what else. I'm a mama to a six-year-old boy and love to have conversations like this with people like yourself. So I'm excited to be here with you.
You know, For you, I always like to ask this question, especially to mental professionals that I respect. What was your journey? Like, what pulled you into this realm of what you do?
Yeah. I think I always say that I've always been a little bit of a seeker and that I've always been curious about what motivates our behaviors and just like a little bit of what we're doing here. I think I've always been a spiritual seeker. So I've always been like, I think a little bit younger than maybe might be normal. I don't know. I was really into like Oprah's Soul series and like really listening to different spiritual teachers sort of like explore, you know, what the human experience is about and what we're doing while we're living in this skin. I've always been fascinated by that. I've always really just been that person that would like write down things that people would say that would feel like really supportive or that made me feel like a little bit of like safety in the understanding of what we're doing here. I think when I was a kid and I would like ask my parents, you know, what happens when we die or like questions about God or what that meant, I feel like I didn't feel very satisfied with their answers. No shade to my parents, but I think I wanted more. I wanted more of an understanding. And I think in a lot of ways that probably led to a fair amount of anxiety when I didn't have a real clear understanding for myself of what that meant for me and finding a sense of safety in my skin. And so I think for me, that anxiety was always something that pulled me to do some of my own inner work and my own seeking to understand. And I always loved therapy. I think it's so funny now when I see clients and they're sort of, you know, I mean, you probably understand this, that most of the time, by the time people get in the chair to come see us, they've been working up to it for a while. It's sort of like, all right, I made it, I'm here. But I was always that person that was psyched for therapy. To me, it was like having a massage. Like I loved sitting and like just being in this like introspective space of attempting to talk about all of the human things for an hour. And so I did therapy off and on, I think, starting in college, but I loved it. And I loved that you could do that work. And I think there was a time when I did some family therapy and it was just like so transformational to see like my mom and people in my family having conversations and realizations that I never thought that they would have in that work. And I was like, God, this is so powerful. And my mom saying like, why don't you do this if you love this that much? Like if it's, you know, that interesting to you. And I think I didn't really have a sense that like you could love something and make that your work for whatever reason. I didn't connect the dots on that. And I sort of thought like, yeah, why don't I? And so I decided to go back to grad school and, you know, pursue doing this work and holding space for others myself.
And so for you, was it right off the bat, you did family therapy and marriage? And because I know a lot of the things you talk about and social media, not that social media is the litmus test for what you do on a day-to-day basis. I know I specialize in relationships and parenting and anxiety, but like I work with everything, you know what I mean? Like that's just, it's not like I'm so niche that if someone says, hey, can I work, you know, I'm struggling with depression. No, get out of my face. You know, I'm not doing that. But what kind of made the niche for you? Like, how did you find that? Because I know, you know, you call yourself a seeker. I was going to ask you about that. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but you went through something called like depth psychology. I know you and Vanessa are like depth psychology. Mm-hmm. What is that? And like, how did you fall into that? And how do you apply that to what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So before I went back to grad school to be a therapist, I was a yoga teacher for many years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the teachers that I crossed paths with, had a background in either depth psychology or spiritual psychology, different things of that nature. So I was already a little bit, you know, just like it was sort of in the periphery of something I was aware of, that there was something called depth psychology. And there was a school called Pacifica in Santa Barbara that is really the only school that depth psychology is the focus. And so what depth psychology is, for those of your listeners who are like, what is she talking about? It's like the psychology of the soul. I like to say that it's really like based more on Jungian psychology, but it's the idea that we look at our lives through the lens of the hero's journey and a really narrative lens. And so it's the study of myth and archetypes and, you know, the ways that we have done a little bit of that seeking throughout history and the ways that we can look at different mythologies and stories and archetypes throughout history. And there's so much similarity in the ways that we've sort of broken down what's happening underneath the human experience. So it's really the exploration of the collective unconscious and mm-hmm. how we are all connected to one another on a soul mm-hmm. level. So I like to say that it's sort of the hero's journey, and that like, if our lives are like the story of our lives, I sit down with clients and we do the exploration of like, what is this chapter of my life really attempting to tune me into, really supporting mm-hmm. me in, mm-hmm. And I find it to just be a little bit more of an empowering way of holding the human experience for me. And I'm fascinated by it. And it feels like there's something about holding ourselves as souls that are having a human experience for a temporary amount of time that just mm-hmm. feels containing to me in that same way that we were talking about, like with the thing of understanding what we're doing here. The other question you were asking me in terms of, you know, I don't know if you've experienced this since you said that you do a lot of family therapy, but when I was in my practicum, and actually like when I moved into my private practice as well, I think therapists either really love working with couples or they don't really have much interest in working with couples.
Love and it. So I love it.
You love it. I love that you love it. That's good to know. And get some referral info for you, because I find
working with couples.
Yeah, I find it can be really hard to find couples referrals that you're like, this is a solid couples therapist, and I like really feel good about the way that they hold space for couples. And so when I was in my practicum, I found like, I loved working with couples so much. I was like fascinated by how I didn't feel activated by the conflict, and I didn't feel, you know, there was just something about it. I felt like I had like a real, like knack for like interpreting what was happening for each person in a way that I could like support them in getting their partner to see and understand and sort of like translate. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt like, oh, I feel kind of good at this. And then I moved in my private practice and they would just be like, give Danae all the couples. She likes mm-hmm. couples. And so I just kind of naturally became primarily a couples therapist. But what's interesting is I really hold couples therapy through that same depth psychological lens, which is a little bit different than a lot of the orientations that, you know, I've studied or that we probably came up with. And it's just a little bit like, if we hold that we are souls, like what is this relationship mm-hmm. meant to teach us about ourselves, right? Like mm-hmm. how do we use it as like a sacred curriculum that is like a mirror showing us aspects of ourselves mm-hmm. that we are meant to know and understand through this relationship. And so I find that it really, you know, I love working with couples because I feel like it makes me believe in love a little bit more when people are just so committed to like showing up and, you know, being conscious in their dynamic. So yeah, it makes me like the hopeless romantic in me feel like really inspired by doing this work.
I feel the same way sometimes when I used to work at a, you know, an outpatient clinic where I was working like 10 to 11 hours a day, getting my hours, mm-hmm. seeing couples, all these things. And I would deal with a lot of different, you know, diversity of cultures and backgrounds and sexual orientation and gender. It was just beautiful, beautiful. And I would come home and I said to my wife, like, I love you. Like, because I would see mm-hmm. such, you know, darkness of couples and mm-hmm. yet also see the power of love. Right. And just, yeah. Fill my heart with so much love, and I love love, and I love relationships and how they interact. And you know, it's funny because I'm a religious Jew, and to mm-hmm. me, soul is a very part of a thought process, of a depth of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that go, you know, hand in hand with some religions, depending on certain parts and sects. And we're not getting into religious studies here. And that idea that you know, the soul's impact on mm-hmm. our worlds and tapping into that energy source is something that I think we forget a lot about. And, you know, you talk about the hero's journey and this archetype. Not to put you on the spot, are there certain heroes that you connect with or that you like in the history of the things that you've studied, or archetypes that you can talk about that you think could be generalized to a lot of people?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's such a, I want to say like vast exploration to me, because I feel like there's so many, you know. I think on a personal level, there's all of these ways that the transition from maiden to mother and like the ways that our society holds mm-hmm. like the goddess and like feminine energy and like the reckoning. I've just finished writing my first book, and it's really about like masculine and feminine energetics. And that's Carl Jung's work is really sort of centered around the idea that all of us have both masculine and feminine energies within us. Mm-hmm. And he referred to them as the anima and the animus. And so I really did like a deep dive exploration into all of the ways that we've been conditioned to think about gender, and then how we are meant to integrate these energetics within ourselves, and what I believe is happening collectively around our reclamation of the feminine. So there's all of these feminine archetypes that I have just been really fascinated with reclaiming within myself, but also, you know, like the fierce warrior archetypes and like the masculine energetic within myself. I just finished a session with my own therapist right before I came in to see you. And we were talking about like the ways that my inner masculine is sort of like witnessing my inner queen and like holding space, and all of these things that we are really, I think collectively from my perspective, having a reckoning with. You know, I don't know how much you experience this in the couples and the people that you sit with, but I just find that there's a really like unspoken war of the sexes happening collectively. And there's just so much about our society that conditions us to not really hold with reverence the other in the way that you're speaking to. And I think we do that because we don't know how to hold those energetics with reverence within ourselves. And so, yeah, I love pulling, this is like sort of a convoluted answer to your question, but I love pulling from all of these different archetypes and just like feeling inspired by like which goddess feels alive in me today, or do I want to like draw inspiration from and attempt to embody that? But I think there's a way that like I love to like pull out books about myth with my little boy and just like, you know, read these stories and just like feel comfort in the holding of like there's something about these stories that are so similar to the collective experience of what we're going through ourselves. And I have certainly you know, that like transition from maiden to mother, and then what is it sort of feel like or look like to embody, if it doesn't feel true to be that crone energy yet, to maybe be in that space of like high priestess energy, or you know, like the woman who holds some wisdom because she's a little bit older, which our society doesn't really teach us as women to like value that. And so I've really been in this space of like, no, I'm embodying that and I'm loving that and I'm gonna claim it, and it feels empowering. So I guess just really yeah, like playing with it, I guess, is a little bit of the long answer to your question.
I love long answers. It makes it interesting for me to listen to, so I'm happy. But, you know, I think it's so interesting how a lot of people, you know, put down or poo-poo, you know, myths and these stories of humans. When, yeah, okay, do I know that Hercules lived? Do I know that Greek mythology is true? Or other gods and goddesses and that existed in the past, or the views of other cultures and their vision of you know, how their world worked and the connection they have to those stories. I don't know if it's true, but I can learn a lot from it. And I think that, to me, combining what you said before as being a seeker, I think that we have lost that, like the curiosity and openness to learn. Like I deal with this a lot. I get asked, you know, as a therapist, I get asked as a, you know, as a religious person, like, how do you believe in that? Right. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know if I believe or not, depends on the day. That's not the problem or the issue for me. The issue is, what can I learn from this? And it's not just this, it's what can I learn from anything? And there's a line in the world that I grew up, that a smart person is someone who learns from all, right? It's everything, beautiful. Right? It's not just your world, it's all worlds. And that's past, present, and future, to be able to just keep your brain, your mind, your soul, your heart, whatever you want to say, open to learning and seeking and understanding and gaining knowledge and consciousness of the world. And I think in this day and age, we struggle so hard with that and get so restricted. And that's what I see, by the way, is a problem with a lot of couples that I deal with, is that they're so restricted in their viewpoint and cannot see someone else's perspective. And even just, I don't know if you deal with this a lot, but I deal with a lot of teaching someone just the simple words of validating is not the agreeing, but saying, I see you. I just see you. I'm open to your opinion. I hear your thoughts. I understand this matters to you. My brain and heart are open to you. People are so afraid to do that because they think it means something like I agree or you are right, which who cares about those things as well? But we're so close-minded sometimes to be so siloed within our own little world that we lose so much knowledge and power of reading and listening and learning. That to me is one of the biggest struggles of today's world. You know, what do you think?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you said so many things that I was like, yes, yes. But, you know, my, no, I mean, it was brilliant. I loved it. But, you know, my friend, John Kim, who you met, John is Vanessa's partner, like both ways, whatever. But John often says, seek to understand before seeking to be understood. And I think that to me, in terms of couples work, has been such a game changer because you're right. I think when it comes to our relationships in general, we are so aware that we are complex within ourselves, right? Like I like to use the example with couples a lot of times, like, so if I'm late, I take into account all of the variables that made me late, right? Like my coworker didn't have that thing for me. There was a red light. There was like all of these like things that led to me being late. And it happens like it wasn't my intention, right? Yeah. But when my partner is late, I think that they're like an inconsiderate a-hole, right? Like that's just like so often where I go. Like I don't take into account the most generous interpretation of what could have conceivably happened. Now, it's very human of us, but I think that there's a way that if we bring a little bit of grace into seeking to empathize with what things feel like for this other person, that to me is collectively what I think we are missing. And I think a lot of that has to do, from my perspective, with the fact that we are just such an egocentric culture. We are so like me and mine and my family and like how this feels for me and versus like really attempting to connect. And to me, that's like the disregard for the feminine within all of us, right? The feminine is the energetic that collaborates and that really is like in the vulnerable space of holding with grace. And I believe that that is like where we are returning. You know, you said something that made me think of like how much we've gotten in such a linear, like, oh, I remember what you said. You were talking about like, do you really believe these stories? And I think there was a point where we moved away from collectively the value that we place on religions. Now, to me, it's interesting that we're talking about this, but religions, all of them are beautiful expressions of the human need to attempt to understand why we're here, right? Yep. I have taken so much wisdom, and I'm by no means a religious scholar, but I have taken so much wisdom from all of the various religions. And I think of myself as a very spiritual person, but I think when you really break down like what so many of the religious texts are speaking to through these stories that are essentially metaphors, like you're saying, for lessons, right? Like, I don't think we're supposed to take them like face value. And literally, it's a little bit like, no, there's a lesson here that this is a metaphor that we are meant to understand. Yeah. But I think we've lost collectively our desire to make meaning of our lives, which is what I think like the religious context does, right? Like it's like, what is the mission here? What is the larger purpose of what we're doing? And I think this linear, like, you know, I'm just going to like stick with the science and I'm just going to do with like the things that I can see and touch and taste and feel. And if it's not that, then it's not real. I think that has really made us lose sense of the sacred. Not only within the world around us, but within one another. And I think that that's, to me, the return to the feminine is us returning to holding one another and our lives with a little bit more of that sacred energy.
You know, the reason why I'm really into this conversation, of course, we're going to get back to other things. I'm reading a book called Soul Boom by Rainn Wilson.
Yes. I've heard him talk about it on several podcasts, but I haven't.
I'm trying so hard to get him on the show just because of, I agree with so much what he's saying is the idea of spirituality, a spirituality revolution, a spiritual revolution, and stop focusing on God and big words like that. He said that he tried pitching a TV show called The Notorious G.O.D. to have like, like to Hulu and Netflix and all these things. And they said, no, it's too controversial.
Yeah.
And he's like, but you have nudity and like crazy things on your shows. That's okay. But the search for answers of all walks of life, including religions, atheists, scientists, anyone and everyone, to answer questions of why, isn't that more important? And they were like, sorry, it's too controversial. And he said, the spiritual world, the spirit, has become a four-letter word. Like spirituality has become a four-letter word that you cannot say. So on that topic of the viewpoint of yes, Hollywood's not the goal standard, but how do you get people to sign on that soul-searching perspective when that's something that people kind of are not used to, are not open to, maybe have had bad experiences with what the soul, whether it's religious, spiritual, their parents, where they grew up, how do you kind of create a way for that to be digestible in the mental health world and in your office?
Yeah, I love this question. Because I think what you're saying is really important, and something that I love to speak to with clients is that many of us have experienced various forms of religious trauma and ways that religion has been weaponized to really, you know, disconnect us from ourselves and from our truth and from our own knowing. And, you know, again, I want to reiterate that I love and pull so much wisdom from all of the various religions. And to me, the distinction between religion and spirituality is that often I believe religion gives you a set of things like, this is truth, right? Whereas spirituality sort of says, like, use some tools, get out there and define truth for yourself, right? So I will say to clients, I have no interest nor ability or authority in telling you what your truth should be. I believe that's your work. I think it's just like when someone tells you something, like I'm sure like any of us who've done therapy have had the experience of like, I think therapy is planting seeds. So I can say something to you, but until you have the felt visceral experience of whatever it is for yourself, I think it's just sort of theory. But I think once I've experienced something and walked that path and really breathed into that space of this is like true for me, you can't talk me out of it, right? Like that is just the truth I know to be true. But in alignment with what you were saying, you know, I was a real, I was a yoga teacher for many years that never said the word God. I was very like aware of wanting to not offend people, or a little bit of my people pleasing tendencies. Like that's a little where it used to kick in. And I think it's been the last couple years that I have really come into the space of like, I am not meant to be for everyone. And I think what has been most supportive of me and my journey is to really embody and accept the spiritual principles that have been most supportive of me on my path. And I think that is how I am best able to be of service. Now, from a depth psychology perspective, we sort of believe that like psyche will bring the clients to us that we are meant to work with and that we are meant to be supportive of. And so I find I'm not interested in convincing anyone of anything. You know, this either resonates or it doesn't. And either way, beautiful. It's exactly as it's meant to be. But I think these principles, even if I don't speak to them in the context of like God, they hold true and they hold to be like the larger truths of what I believe that it is to be alive and how we hold space for one another, you know.
I love that. I didn't think this conversation was going to go this direction, but I'm loving it. I'm really, I love it.
Because psyche enters and, you know, just decides. I love it.
I love it. You know, your work and perspective on relationships is really, really beautiful. And there's a lot of heart in what you do, and a lot of, you work a lot with energy and all that kind of stuff. And you had a line about something that I never expected, and not in a bad way, that codependency can be healthy. And I recently saw you that? Post like the health, like, the health. Interesting. I don't know.
That might've been maybe Vanessa.
But, the idea of, and maybe I'm misquoting, I'm going to do some back research right now just to make sure.
I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm interested what I meant by that.
That's what I'm asking. That the idea of the connection to each other, right? That's really what I want to talk about. That how are we able to be connected to people, feel connected to people, yet not get so reliant on others? to the point where it can be hurtful? And is there a healthy side to that connection? How do we keep that balance in within our relationships, whether it's our individuality or our sense of self? I know you talk about that often, so I wanted to pick your brain about that.
Yeah. I mean, I believe, and this is sort of the hill I'm willing to die on, that we are just a really codependent society. I think there's so much about our fairy tales and the ways that we are taught to like hold what it is to love another person. And then we live happily ever after and you complete me. And like, there's just so much about what I think we are taught to believe love is that really, to me, ends up leading to a lot of self-abandonment and not being a full embodied self and looking to that other person to complete me. To me, codependency is, you know, that I'm okay if we're okay. Or it's like basically how we regulate our internal world or our internal nervous system. We do that through our relationship with another person. The trouble with that I find is, you know, people are sort of that variable that are outside of our control. People will, for all kinds of reasons, be human and not be able to be the thing that we can regulate ourselves through. And when we can't, what I find ends up happening is we end up, quote, loving one another in some very unloving ways. We attempt to manipulate and control and people please and make our needs smaller and not be true to ourselves because we're just attempting to maintain the attachment. And I believe it doesn't have to be that way. I think what ends up happening a lot of times when we realize that we've been in sort of codependent dynamics, really attempting to maintain our attachments at all costs, is we swing to hyper-independence. And so I might have been speaking about the fact that like we need to come somewhere in the middle, that interdependent space where that is the space to me where you and I can coexist as autonomous humans walking the path together in support of one another's expansion, but we don't minimize the self within the dynamic. We don't become like an enmeshed one. And I think that's really important because, you know, a large aspect of what I'm so passionate about, and I don't know how much you see of this with the couples that you see, is that what we've really normalized is like enmeshment to the extent that we're like roommates or like parentified dynamics, or, you know, I don't like, if I had a dollar for every couple where it's like, you know, my partner never wants to have sex. And it's like, well, it's because we're literally living like roommates and not like that space of like the other that I like can be drawn to and long for. And we just have so normalized that. And again, that's the feminine, right? Like the sensuality, the erotic other of the other person. And there's so much about that that we don't even like hold as something we should prioritize and value, but it matters. And it's life force. And it's like anything, if we don't honor all of these things as necessary and sacred, what we resist persists and it will come to the surface, but it will come to the surface in some maladaptive ways, I find. So really, I think that to me is why it's really important to be autonomous while in partnership. And yes, we need one another. Yes, we are pack animals. We need one another to survive, but we don't need to believe this one person is mine. And, you know, I have ownership over them now and I don't even see them anymore because they're my husband or they're my partner or whoever. I think we should always be in that space of like, no, this person doesn't belong to me. They are their own sacred soul on their own journey. And I get to walk this path beside them as long as that is what is true and beautiful and life-affirming for both of us. But that to me is another thing I think collectively, my goodness, we've sort of lost track of, you know.
And of course, now that I'm looking for the Instagram story or thing that you said, I can't find it. So I misquoted you. I'm sorry, but I'm glad it came out to a good thing. You know, you talk about the idea of progress and growth as individuals, right? And something that I've come in contact with a few couples is the idea where one person is doing growth and the other person is, let's say, happy with where they're at. And they're content. They're you know, enjoying this state. They don't need to read your book. They don't need to read Vanessa's book. They don't need to read, you know, any books out there. They don't need to go to therapy. They're happy. They're good. And it's not that they are being a trouble or struggle in the relationship either. Let's just put that out there, right? Everything's going smoothly. And the other person is growing, right? How do you deal with that as the person who is growing? And how do you express maybe the struggle or frustration where you're growing and the other person seems stagnant? Not that they are, but they seem stagnant. How do we gain perspective on that?
Yeah, well, a couple things. First of all, I think what you're describing in that dynamic is another example to me of the codependent tendencies that we've really normalized, right? Like, I need you to be on the same trajectory that I'm on because it means something about me if you are not here with me mm-hmm. on the same trajectory of growth. Now, I would say that is your objective opinion. Like, it's arguable, right? Like, what growth looks like for one person may not be what growth looks like for another person, but that's a whole other conversation. I think that I heard Meryl Streep say something once that I thought was so fascinating. And I kind of come back to this with couples a lot. She said, whenever I found that someone was asking her how she and her husband have stayed married for so long and they seem to be happy or whatever. But she was saying, you know, whenever I found that I was discontent with him or not happy with our relationship, some part of me was discontent with myself and unhappy with myself, if I really got honest. Now, I find, and I don't know if you would agree with this, but normally when we are in the space of like, I need my partner to be where I feel like they need to be, there's some digger deeping for us to do around like why it feels so unsettling to us that my partner is not where I believe that they should be. Like there's a little bit of righteousness in that, right? And I think that there's something to be said for like, keep doing your work, keep doing your exploration. The relationship will either continue to expand with you, or I believe it will fall away as it's meant to. But there's two things in that. One, I believe that we are a society that just like thinks this like nuclear family, this one person should give me everything that we used to get from an entire village of people. Meaning like this person's meant to be my confidant, my spiritual advisor, my best friend, my travel buddy, my like everything. It's too much. And again, it makes us really enmeshed with one another when I feel like this one person is supposed to be all of the things to me. And again, you can't have that space of like longing for and continuously discovering. I promise you that partner that you think needs to be growing, there are things about that person that if you had a little distance and a little bit of space and a little curiosity, you don't know about them. But we get so close that we're not really in the space of like curiosity about our partners anymore. So one, I think we need to have an entire village of people that we use to sort of support our life and our expansion. And maybe your partner doesn't want to go to the yoga retreat with you, but maybe your girlfriend does. And maybe we need to make that okay. Like maybe he doesn't need to be your entire world and he doesn't need to be shamed for that because maybe you aren't supposed to like all of the same things. And I think that's really what we've been conditioned to believe societally. But also I think letting it be like, there's a fear of like, it means something if this person doesn't want to do all these things with me. Like, is this the right person? Right. And maybe not. I don't know. But I also think there's like a real like, I need to control this person out of fear that we're like right for each other, that this is going to, you know, and I think whenever there's fear, there's like room to go in there and like, let's be curious about it, right? Like, what does it mean if you guys don't have like really similar interests? Like if you guys don't feel turned on by the same things, is it something we can work with? Has the relationship expired and need to change form? I don't know. But I think whatever we're afraid of looking at, there's some value in getting in there and looking at it versus like, you know, making that person wrong for not being where I believe they need to be.
Yeah. You know, I have this thing that I say to a lot of clients that I work with, like you can't have the one cup mentality. One person can fill your cup. And because it's just what you're doing is you're putting so much power and so much disempowerment to yourself, but so much power to someone else to hold all the cards in every aspect of your life versus the ability of one person giving you what they can. And you finding other people that can give you other things. My best buddies are not going to give me what my wife can give me, but my wife can give me things that my best buddies can't. And my family and my kids and myself and this person, a mentor, a colleague, every person fills the cup. And if having one person be the sole proprietor of that cup, I talk a lot about the Holy Trinity what the, you know, just in a joking way, but the way we have our expectations and how the reality and expectations and our perceptions of that world interact. Mm-hmm. So if I expect someone to fill my cup and be the only person, you know, my perception is that they're going to fail. When they don't do it, they're going to fail.
Of course they are.
And then my reality is going to be resentful, hateful, angry, annoyed. But if I have an expectation that you give me what you can give me, that's the reality that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that we so often put such a standard on someone to grow with us, to change with us, to match where we have gone because we did the hard work. Where are you? And this is not values. This is not, you know, things that you talked about when you were dating or when you're now married or together long-term. Those things can shift. And that might be that you're not really meant to be with each other anymore. I know Vanessa talks often about, like, she says that the congrats when people get divorced. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, they finally realize they're not for each other. And I'm like, I never thought of it that way. Right. You can grow. Mm-hmm. So for you, when you work with people, is there a point where you see that it's worth fighting for as a therapist versus where you realize it's important to help them see or come to a conclusion that isn't healthy for them to be together anymore? How do you find that balance as a couples therapist?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things that is difficult to like pinpoint. This is how you know. I love to normalize that the relationship is the client when I'm working with two people. And so I'm always going to be in support of what is best for the relationship. And sometimes that means for it to change form. Mm-hmm. My ex-husband is my best friend on the planet. We love one another so well, not being married and co-parenting together. It's, to me, been such a profound example of when we are brave enough to say this relationship needs to change form. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we love one another better that way, you know? And I think it's really important for us to normalize that societally, because the first thing I experience people saying when a relationship is ending is feeling like they're failing or feeling like there's exile or feeling like, you know, now I should carry some sort of shame about that. And I just don't believe that it needs to be that way at all. You know, my little boy is 6 and he thinks some mommies and daddies are just best friends. Like, that's all he's experienced. Like, he's like, did you ever kiss my dad? That feels weird. You know, like, he has no concept of like anything abnormal about that. But I believe we can design our lives based on like what our values are and what we want to be true. And I don't know. I just think there's a lot, and I'm sure you experience, about like the, like, no, what matters is longevity. What matters is that we stick it out and we stay in it. That really leads to some things that aren't very loving in the way that we're showing up for one another and not the like highest versions of ourselves in these dynamics. And I just really love what you said about the Holy Trinity. You know, I think there's a way that it sort of goes back to what we were saying about losing that connection to meaning and to like some sort of, this is what I believe to be true. I think what we have made our higher power as a society is this other person. And once I find my person, then they're going to be the higher power. That's been everything that I've been longing for my whole life. Everything my parents weren't, they're going to see me and they're going to be that, and they're going to fulfill all that. And oh my gosh, are we let down when this other human is not able to do that? Right. Exactly. It's like, it's too much. It's not reasonable. And it's sort of childlike, like not even childlike. It's just childish. Right. And I think that we're being asked, from my perspective, to collect mature in the way that we are holding what it is to love one another. And that means like, no, I am walking this path with you, another human. And every day that I have you in my life, whatever form that is in, I'm blessed to know you. I'm blessed to have you. And I want to hold it as that, you know?
I love that. Last couple of questions, because then, you know, I could talk to you for hours about this. Two questions. One, how do you help individuals find and connect to their soul when they've never done it before? That's the first question. Then I have one more question afterwards.
Oh, how do I support them in connecting to their souls? You know, Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss and doors will appear where there were only walls. I think we always know the path back to our souls. It's just about giving ourselves permission to follow our bliss, to follow the things that make us feel alive. And then it just unfolds. We just find our way there. I think we know how to be ourselves. There's this guy, I think his name is Jack Canfield. He wrote like Chicken Soup for the Soul. I think that's his name. I'm not sure. But I heard him on Oprah once saying that he has never had a conversation with someone who said they didn't know their purpose or what they were meant to do when that wasn't the truth. And I remember hearing him say that and being like, what? That can't be true. Like a lot of people don't know what their purpose is or what they want. And he was like, not once. It's just that we've been so conditioned that we need to be practical. We need to be realistic. We need to like do the smart thing that we lose track of ourselves and the truth of what we want for ourselves. And I got to tell you, Eli, ever since I heard him say that, I've been playing with it with clients for like years now, because so often that's like a point of struggle is like, I don't know what I want. I don't know what I want my life to be. I don't know what my purpose is. I don't know, you know, and that's ultimately the soul space is like, you know, what am I doing here? You know, what is my destiny? What do I long for with this one wild and precious life that I have to accomplish and do and be? But I have yet to find one person when we really get back to the space of like, who were you before the world told you who you needed to be, that they don't know. Like they always know. We always know the truth of our souls. I just believe healing is remembering who we were before the layers of all the stuff got piled on. It's just sort of like peeling back the onion to get back to self. So I think we know.
Who were you before someone told us differently? I love that. That's so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, The last thing I would ask is for anyone who's listening, right? Who might be going through relationship struggles or couple struggles, and what would be one to three things that you can help or give advice on that people might not have heard from a different avenue or a different perspective or whatever book they've read that you feel is very close to your heart about relationships and couples? Maybe one to three, you pick.
Okay. So the first thing that my mentor taught me about relationships that I always come back to and has been the most fundamental truth is the only way anything changes in a dynamic between two people is if each person takes 100% responsibility for what they are bringing to the dynamic, not their 50%, not their 60%, but 100% responsibility. Meaning if this person never changes one thing whatsoever, what am I going to do? How am I going to show up differently? How am I going to shift the paradigm between us? And if each person is willing to do that versus pointing the finger out at the other person, that is when I feel that dynamics have the ability to shift in whatever way they're meant to, right? So I would say, instead of focusing on that other person, how can you bring the focus inward to yourself? And really what you can do to change the energetic dynamic between the two of you. The other thing I would say, and this is something that I believe so strongly and has completely shifted my perspective on love, is that I believe we are raised with a very transactional idea of what love is. Like, you do this for me and then I'll do it for you, right? Like, this person makes me feel this and that's why I love them. They do this for me and that's why I love them. I believe that love is about what we can give, not what we can get. And so I think we're taught to think when we meet the love of our lives that it will be all about how that person is experiencing me, right? In reality, I believe that when we really meet the love of our lives, we feel so inspired by who that person is that we want to rise to be the highest version of ourselves so that we can meet them there. And so it really becomes like love is a mirror and showing you where there's room for you to grow and where there's room for you to evolve. And this person becomes the catalyst if you're willing to see it that way. So whatever the activation is, whatever the fear is, because there's nothing more vulnerable than standing in front of another person saying, can you love me? Mm-hmm. But whatever that is, can you use it as an opportunity to rise into everything that you are capable of being? And in that way, I think that our love lives can be a lot more inspiring than we've been holding them to be.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Now, I know you said you finished your book.
I mean, it's like with my editor, but yeah, it's being so exciting. Released next year.
I cannot wait to share it, read it, share it even more. I'm sure it's going to be wonderful and magical and beautiful and all its hard work, blood, tears and sweat and heart. and I really appreciate you being on the show today. It means a lot.
Oh, such an honor. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. It means a lot to me because without you, the listeners, this podcast can't happen. So every listen, every download, every rate, review, and share means so much to me. And I hope you enjoyed these conversations as much as I did. Talking about wellness, mental health, and relationships is one of my passions. And that's what this podcast is all about. So thanks so much for tuning in. As always, if you have any questions, concerns, ideas, thoughts, collaborations, email me at thedudetherapist@gmail.com. Always feel free to DM me on Instagram @thedudetherapist. Don't forget to be kind to yourself and to others. And as always, see you next time on the Dude Therapist podcast.